The Capital Investment Committee hearing for April 14th is called to order. Members, we do not have a quorum yet, and so we're going to move to our PAC agenda today. Just want to say thank you all to the members of the public joining us for our hearing today. First off, we'll be starting on bills that we heard informationally. We have two bills from Representative Keeler, and then after that, we'll move on down the agenda. And so, members, just so you know, we have allotted 15 minutes for each bill or each portion. That includes testimony and question and answer. And so for our testifiers, if you guys could keep your remarks short, that would be helpful. Welcome, Representative Keeler. Please present your two bills.
Thank you, Chair Lee and members. I'm really excited to be here. We've spent a lot of time making historic investments to end homelessness. We know that housing and homelessness, but shelters save lives. And so what we have been able to do, in 2023, we passed historic legislation around the Pathway Home Act, which we know was just the beginning of a catch-up effort on the areas that we've left behind. What we'll talk about today is the impacts that we've had in this effort, but there is so much left to do, and making this investment actually saves lives. One of the biggest things that I'm the most proud of in this work is we've taken a new approach to funding, making sure that 40% of this funding goes to Greater Minnesota, meaning outside the seven county metros. As a Greater Minnesota member, it is really, really important that all of us have the opportunity to get state funding. And with that, Chair, I'll hand it over to Matt Traynor.
Welcome, Director Traynor. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, Chair Lee and committee members. My name is Matt Traynor. I am the Executive Director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We are a statewide organization with a mission to generate policies, community support, and resources for housing and services to end homelessness in Minnesota. I also want to say we receive zero of the funds that we advocate for. In 2023, as Representative Keeler said, we passed legislation approving $100 million in one-time funding for creating and enhancing shelters. This led to over 1,450 new and improved shelter beds, with 50% of the funds being allocated in the metro and 50% in Greater Minnesota. While this was a great start to addressing the need, there was over $365 million in requests, meaning just under 75% of the needs were not met. So this didn't happen overnight. Starting in 2016, MCH, Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, held listening sessions throughout the entire state with people living outside, in shelter, and within service programs, including frontline staff. This led us to launch an unsheltered homelessness campaign to advocate for a stronger homeless response system. It was disheartening to learn how little lawmakers knew about the complicated and vastly underfunded system that was intended to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. At the core of this system is temporary housing known as emergency shelters. In order to try and simplify what lawmakers needed to know, we utilized the message, shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. It was very effective, but one disadvantage of using a catchy tagline is that it doesn't tell the whole story. While I don't have time to tell the entire story, I want to share some proof of what can happen when we give people an opportunity to work on their goals. MCH operates a lived experience fellowship that creates a space for individuals who have lived without a place to call their own. It has been a smashing success, but MCH can only take credit for providing the framework for these leaders to realize their potential. The accomplishments we've achieved together is due to the fellows sharing their skills and talents into our shared advocacy. MCH's Homeless Day on the Hill has doubled in size. Our annual conference has grown by over 50%. And our legislative outcomes have been amazing. This is due to our emphasis on leading with people who have lived experience. So when you think of shelters saving lives, please also remember that shelters are also the starting point for long-term stability. Mm-hmm. I mention this because if an organization with three staff and four fellows can accomplish all this, just think what the individuals who find stability at a shelter can do, provided the organizations running them have the resources and capacity to do what is needed. If we want Minnesota to be a state where individuals and families can thrive, the legislature needs to believe in people who have been homeless just as much as we do. That's what this bill is trying to do, as you as legislators have an opportunity to prove you believe in them. Now, just quickly, in order to share a few tangible examples of what some of the $100 million was able to do, Here's a few shelters in or near districts of some committee members in greater Minnesota that receive funding. Servants of Shelter in Couchiching County converted an old motel into shelter and housing. AEOA on the Range converted an old group home into a shelter. Grace House in Itasca County renovated their shelter to add 15 new beds, improve 10, and create a safer and more private shelter. United Community Action Partnership in Kandy, Ohio renovated an old hotel to create 50 new beds. And finally, Mojave Ottawa Community Action in Otter Tail created tiny homes with 8 new beds and a focus on veterans. Thanks for considering this important legislation because shelter saves lives while also being the starting point to long-term stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Next up, we have Tribal Secretary Sam Strong from the Red Lake Nation who's testifying remotely. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Bonjour, bimose gnu indigenous, makwan du dem, miskwagamui zagani donjaba, ogakaning inda. Hello everyone, my name is Sam Strong. I'm Secretary of the Red Lake Nation. It's an honor to speak before you here today on behalf of our members that are experiencing homelessness. Here in Red Lake, in a 2023 Wilder study, there were 627 people experiencing homelessness here on the reservation. And so a population of approximately 7,000 people, that's near 10% of our population, are dealing with homelessness issues. And so these are families, these are mothers and fathers and children, people that are suffering. And as you are well aware, we're in northern Minnesota here, and the climate is not kind to us in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And so as you see people and you think of homeless people, think of our members and, you know, the negative 20 degree weather that they have to live through. You know, this is a dire situation where our people are suffering. And so it's really important that we recognize that this issue is worlds above any other place in America. This is a situation that needs help. And so we were able to get help in the form of this money for our homeless, new homeless camp. And so ultimately what that does is it helps bring our people off of, in our regard, off of the streets, or in this case, off of a very dire situation. And so as we move forward, it's important to recognize that we got to continue to invest in these communities where people are struggling. I always try to think of that mother that's trying to take care of their children, trying to provide a safe space to bring them to school. And how can we do that if we don't have a place to get them off the street, a place to really provide that strength that we all should have as human beings, a house over our head, a meal, clothes, you know, these basic human necessities. Without that, they can't overcome the issues they're faced with. And so our new project will not only help them get off the streets, but it will help them heal. And so this is important. It's an opportunity for them to, in many cases, they're dealing with mental health issues and drug abuse issues. And so this is a place for them to heal, a place for them to get better, and to become a contributing member of society. Stop that cycle of poverty that we see here in Red Lake, stop that cycle of addiction, and ultimately heal our people in a good way. And so I really want to make sure that you guys understand that this is for real human beings that are suffering. And so I know you never want to compare suffering, right? That's never a good thing to do. But when you think of the resources, the limited resources that we have as a state, let's put it to where it matters most. Let's put it to the Native people that really need your help and that can really help grow our community in a good way. And so on behalf of the Red Lake Nation, I want to say miigwech for all your hard work. I know, Heather, you've been a great advocate for those that are less fortunate. And many times I'll end with this, that, you know, these oftentimes aren't the constituents that our politicians seek to find support. Many of them don't even vote, right? Because they can't even worry about these much higher issues because they're dealing with just trying to survive. And so I want to say miigwech to Heather and for the rest of you for standing up for those that don't have a voice, and for helping with this very important project in Red Lake to provide a safe place for our people to get better, to heal, and ultimately, Miigwech, for all of your work, your collective work in helping to really just give our people hope. So with that, I'll end it to say Miigwech.
Thank you, Secretary. Next up, we have Tatiana Haynes. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Co-Chairman Francis and Co-Chairman Lee, and to the members of the Capital Investment Committee. My name is Tatiana Haynes, and it is an honor to be here today to share my experience and to urge you to support bills number HF4736 and HF4737. So to start, I am a former youth from the Bridge for Youth, and this is important to me because while being at the Bridge and being supported, I was one of the mothers, a teen mother, and that was really the reason that I was in need of the shelter at the Bridge. And I feel like without that support and without that housing piece, I wouldn't have had the support that I needed for my child and myself, along with finishing school and bettering becoming as a mother. And the positive impact that it's had on me now, I'm currently in my junior year of college, going to school for law. And yeah, the need for more shelter and bed housing units, particularly for youth up to the ages of 24, is at a critical stage. I'd like to share about the needs of young families in particular. According to the Wilder Research Legislative Support from April 2026, there are currently 5,000 young parents and their children accessing the homeless response system across Minnesota, with only 161 shelter beds and housing units that particulars are for youth. This is a clear demonstration of the need across Minnesota and the drastic lack of options available to youth. Having shelter and housing for youth rather than exposing them to the adult system is important for their developmental and safety purposes and assure the greater success for us. If I didn't have the Bridge, I'm really not sure where I would be today, me or my son, and I'm just grateful that now we are here, I'm able to be here today, and we're thriving. Again, I encourage you to support the following bills, HF4736 and HF4737, so that youth across Minnesota have the same opportunity to find immediate safety, a sense of belonging where they can be seen for who they are, and find a community that love and support them. On behalf of all youth experiencing homelessness in Minnesota, thank you for listening to your heart as you make decisions on these bills. We appreciate and need your leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Tatiana. Next up, we have Chloe Rosabella. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Chairs Lee and Franzen for having me here today. My name is Chloe Rosabella, and I am currently a member of the Link's Youth Advisory Committees and also live in one of their housing programs. My experiences with the Link have been very beautiful, eventful, and a life-changing opportunity. Being able to be part of an organization that cares for its young people who are experiencing or experience homelessness and sex trafficking feels honorable and very great. Growing up, I had to deal with a lot of challenges, trauma, and violence. Due to this, I ended up experiencing homelessness and exploitation, among many other things. I ended cycling in and out of child protection, foster care homes that didn't work out, and then ended up at the Link. When I was 12, they helped me with a safe place to live through their Passageways Emergency Shelter, which helped me so much with school, healthcare, supporting me around my goals and more. I have been through a lot of challenges. I have worked very hard to get to where I am today, which is someone who has graduated from high school and has a job and a goal of becoming a mortician. I am proud of where I am today, but was one of many who needed to have the help of emergency shelter in order to get to where I am today. I strongly urge all of you to support Housing Files 4736 and 4737. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chloe. And members, in the interest of time, I just want to note that the chief executive of the Link and the president of the Bridge for Youth is here should you have any questions for them. And so, members, any discussions? Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Representative Keeler, and also to our testifiers. I appreciate you sharing your stories. There's a lot that resonates for me, and I just want to put a third face on it. When I was in my 20s, as many of you know, I was in a violent situation, and I, after some couch surfing, ended up in shelter. And it was the healing environment. It was the place of safety where I knew that the people were there to support me and to support my son, who was only a baby. And I am so grateful for the work that gets done. And that's why I have, in my time here, supported bills like this and continue to. And I ask for our support for the Link to support our youth and to support all people who are going, we're all just a crisis away. And if we hold that in our hearts as we move forward, I think it helps us make good decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to thank you and Representative Keeler for bringing this bill. This is an important bill, and I support it. And let me just say it's a statewide problem, even in my district, Plymouth, a prosperous community, we have homelessness. There's an organization called Interfaith Outreach and Community Partners. They deal a lot with homelessness. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you for coming forward and speaking. It's not your normal day. Appreciate you coming here. And I do want to thank the Kuching, that is the district I represent, and the hotel. It's interesting, the owners were trying to find something they wanted to give back to the community and trying to help in a million different ways, and this came up, and I was like, good, I'm glad something stuck, you know, because he really wanted to help the community in a way and still try to find some profit out of it. But I think the city of Duluth is trying to work through a homeless shelter now too. I can't remember the name of it, but I've for being a rural legislator, it seems like I've been exposed to a lot of homelessness in this position and seeing it. And I think, Representative Ryer, didn't we go to one in your district by a church, if I remember right? It was really a moving experience for me because these were mothers that were trying to get away from the abusive relationship and all the, I just imagine living secretively all the time, and it's like we're better than that. Humans are better than that. So, any help, you know, that I can help. I mean, I don't know where we are in all of this right now, but I appreciate you guys coming forward and trying to help. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scrow. Members, further discussions. Seeing none, I just want to say thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing these. Bill's proposal for and the two of you for sharing your stories really is impactful when we hear from people that's directly impacted. And so just want to say thank you for spending the morning with us. Closing comments, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I just want to kind of mention what you were talking about and is why I think the way that this grant was written is so amazing for Greater Minnesota, because we know, you know, it's a geographic spread on who can get to the Capitol to ask for funds for their projects. And it's hard when we live 4 to 5 hours away, and we know we have needs too, and then setting it up this way allowed for Greater Minnesota to have more access. We've been able to put millions of dollars into communities that maybe would have never seen it. And so keeping a structure like this, I think, is really impactful. And I think we just have to not let up the gas. We've seen how impactful it can be around ending veterans' homelessness. And I think we could be on a track to be a state to end all homelessness as well. Wopita.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Next up, we have House File 4840, Vice Chair Frederick, as he makes his way up. Representative Sexton, can I get a motion to approve the minutes of April 9th? Mm-hmm. Representative Sexton moved the approval of the minutes for April 9th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevailed and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Sexton. Welcome, Vice Chair. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 4840 seeks to address an issue that is impacting every single county in the state. The software systems that our counties use that impact SNAP assistance, cash assistance, healthcare eligibility, and others is a system that is older than me. And so it needs to get updated, and I brought a testifier with to kind of paint that picture better. But you will see in the packet there's some pictures of the actual software, and you can see that it kind of should remind anyone who remembers Oregon Trail and the green screens back in the day. That's kind of what they have to work with, where it's just manually – that's an interesting face, Representative Franson, Chair Franson. So it just needs to get updated, and I'd like to turn it over to the testifier.
Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Jenny Mojo. I am a Clay County Commissioner, and I also serve as second vice president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 4840, Vice Chair Representative Frederick's proposal to authorize lease purchase financing for modernization of the state's Maxis system. Because this is not just an IT upgrade, it is core infrastructure for how we serve people. We often think of capital investment as roads, bridges, and buildings, and those are very essential. But counties also rely on something less visible and just as critical. The technology systems that power the public services that we provide every day. In Clay County, our eligibility systems support about 7,700 residents on SNAP and more than 16,000 on medical assistance. That's over 23,000 individuals, roughly one-third of the population of my community, that depend on this system to work accurately and efficiently. But the systems they rely on today were built in the 1980s, and while children born in the 1980s tend to be pretty awesome, the technology from the 80s is not. Our frontline staff are navigating outdated technology that requires manual data entry, multiple systems that are not communicating with each other, and that duplication creates inefficiencies and increases the risk of errors while pulling staff time away from directly servicing or serving our residents. Modernization gives us a different path. It allows us to do the work faster and more accurately, improve customer service and retain staff by letting them focus on the people in which we serve instead of just the processes. And without it, we are left to keep pace with growing federal requirements by adding staff just to maintain those current service levels. And that approach does not move us forward. And those costs ultimately fall on our local taxpayers. This proposal offers a responsible solution. Lease purchase financing allows the state to make critical upgrades now while spreading costs over time and maintaining the flexibility for our future legislatures. Minnesota has also recognized IT systems as critical infrastructures, and this is the next step, aligning our investment tools with that reality. This is also a priority shared by all 87 counties across Minnesota, all of the counties in which you represent here today. And there is an opportunity to hear to lead. By advancing this approach, Minnesota can be at the forefront of how states invest in modern, effective public service systems. And at its core, this is about people. It is about a parent waiting for food assistance, the senior relying on healthcare coverage, and the caseworkers doing their best every day with tools that are decades behind. But it is also about our taxpayer, who expects efficient, effective government with strong controls in place to ensure that funds are responsibly used and that services are delivered right the first time. Thank you for hearing these comments and concerns, for taking part in system demonstrations, and for thinking critically about how to address these issues. We appreciate your engagement and your willingness to work towards real solutions. We can do better, and this bill helps us to get there. Thank you for the time and the consideration and the opportunity to be before you today, and I respectfully ask for your support.
Thank you, Commissioner Mojo. Before we turn to members' discussion, I heard that we have a special guest here. Would you like to introduce him, please?
Chair Lee, thank you for the opportunity. I'm really excited that my fifth grade son, Lakin Mojo, who I told I would not do this to him, but Lakin is having a two-day civic engagement lesson with mom at the Capitol. And so this is the first up committee hearing, so thank you for allowing him to be part. I know I've observed you with your children here as well, so thank you for allowing him in this space.
Welcome, Lincoln, for joining us today. Chair Franzen.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Archerly. Representative Frederick, the reason for my face was that I don't think you're old enough to know what Oregon Trail is all about.
Representative Frederick.
You know, we don't need to go into some details, Chair Franzen. Mm-hmm. I have played it before. It was might have been one of the first video games I ever played. But that just highlights how important it is that this legislation gets passed so we can update the systems across the state to make our county's jobs easier.
Chair Franzen.
I don't think you know the fun that we had playing on a Mac 2 Evil, so with the floppy disk that you had to turn over. But thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Chair Fredericks and Commissioner. I met with St. Louis County, Lake County, Cooch County, all of them, every five counties I represent, and every county is screaming, we need technology update. And we knew about this years ago, and it's kind of come to a head right now. But I think the biggest was the for the SNAP and medical assistance, the penalties that we're getting for erroneous entries. And it's because of, like, what Representative Stevenson, Chair Stevenson said, you know, like, how can you do this? Johnson, I quit. I can't do it. I wrote the programs in 1980 to 85 in college, basic, Fortran, all these different programs that you're using here, they're antiquated. It shouldn't even be part of this system. And I'm disappointed that, you know, in 22, 23, 24, that we didn't put funding away when we had massive amounts of it, because it will only benefit us to upgrade this system. It is not putting money towards a bad thing. It's the amount of money that we will save in federal funding from the error rate on the IT, on the Medicaid alone justifies this. And I look forward to following this through. I pray that we finally do this because it is so needed. I don't know how we retain employees. I mean, if you graduate from college, you've got touch screens and you got everything, and then here's your job. And you don't even get a mouse. You got to use the keyboard with the arrows. And they're looking at you like, why am I working for you? So we can't do it fast enough. And thank you for all you're doing. Thanks for the bill.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank the committee for hearing this bill. Hopefully we can get this funded. I think Representative Scraba also painted a pretty clear picture. It is a mainframe system in a smartphone world. So hopefully we can get this updated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carroll.
This is a question for the author. So I have experience working with the PRISM system. Is this related at all? And that was old when I was working on it. There's a child support system.
Representative Frederick.
How I would say that is that there is more than one system that needs to get updated at the county level. This is one of many. This is perhaps one of the oldest systems, but this will hopefully be a building block that we can go for years to come to continue to update all of the different systems that exist.
Follow up. Representative Carroll.
Well, that's a very clever way of pivoting to saying I don't know, which is fine because I don't either. That's why I asked the question. But my experience was with working in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I got transferred to child support. I'm still not sure why. But anyway, it was a good experience in that I was dealing with underserved, underprivileged people. I had been doing it at a higher level representing the health plan, Metropolitan Health Plan, the Safety Net Health Plan. So here I was dealing with the Safety Net folks, and we had to use this old antiquated system called PRISM to deal with child support calculations and eligibility and all that. So it needed to be updated, you know, 10 years ago, if not before. So thank you. If there's at all related, thank you for bringing this.
So we do have somebody from the Department of Human Services here, Peter Butler, or... Welcome. Please identify yourself and answer the question that Representative Kiro asked. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lee. For the record, I'm Peter Butler. I'm the Deputy Budget Director here at the Department of Human Services. And Representative, my apologies, could you repeat the question?
Representative Kiro.
The question is, does this at all relate or help the PRISM system, updating the PRISM system?
You know, overall, I think there are two systems. We would double check with our staff to confirm if there's any sort of overlap just with what the potential upgrades would be with it. But these are two systems that work in conjunction with each other, but they are distinct modules.
Representative Kiro. Chair Kosnick.
Thank you here. Obviously a very critical, important issue that we have in front of us. Is there a problem? So there's one approach to it. I'm curious on the mechanics. So we're going to borrow $10 million annually and then have the general fund make the payments on that. If Mr. Chair, if maybe Mr. Lee could help us. I'm just curious like what the annual general fund impact would be on those debt service.
Andy Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, if you look at the bill on page 4, starting on line 4.14, you see the lease purchase appropriation. So you can see it is $10 million a year in general fund appropriation, which I suppose could be either it would be used to support a lease purchase agreement. For the committee, I could probably get back to you on some history. This would be similar to the approach of the 2009 SWIFT certificates of participation for the state accounting system. But if you're looking for where the money is, it's on page 4.
Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. And then how does that affect our debt capacity as well, or that interaction?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, if it would be, if the state enters into a lease purchase agreement, yes, it would count towards guideline 1 capacity and guideline 2 capacity.
Chair Kosnick.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. And obviously, this is a big issue that across the state is impacting every single county and the work that we do here. So I appreciate the approach and have, I think there will probably be other ideas to it too, but. Thanks for the clarification, and it is an important topic to address, and hopefully we can come up with some good solutions.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. And then I think I see Deputy Director Hilgert from the Association of Minnesota Counties to potentially answer Representative Kiro's question. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiro, my name is Matt Hilgert. I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and thanks for the invitation to come up here and clarify. I think the department did a great job of giving just a preliminary answer. The long story is, though, that it is complicated. I mean, I'm holding up a matrix right here where this bill singles out MAXIS, which is from 1989, and does public assistance, eligibility, and some health care eligibility. There's METS, which is from 2013. There's MEC squared 2, which is from 2007. There's MIMS, which is from 1994. There's PRISM, which you referenced, which is from 1997. And there's SSIS. The longer answer is that these should all be able to talk about it. The best example I've been given on these systems is it's like you're at an airport where the terminals don't connect. So you're in the Delta hub, and all of a sudden you have to catch your transfer flight on American Airlines, and you can't actually get there because they are built separate, and there's no airport module connecting them. So this one specifically targets MAXIS, but I think that the vision that we have is that MAXIS is part of that airport model. They might be the terminal, but it's connected by a system, an underpinning system by the state, that where these systems are speaking to each other. So when we're putting inputs in MAXIS, that we don't have to re-enter them in PRISM or SSIS or others. And that's, I'm sorry, thanks for the opportunity to kind of explain that vision, but this bill is specifically targeted at MAXIS. That doesn't mean that we can't be doing other things behind the scenes or in different departments or different funding bills to actually build that layer behind the scenes that actually connects them all. MAXIS, though, is the one that is literally almost hitting its 50-year mark. So thank you.
Thank you, Director. And real quickly before I turn it over to Vice Chair Frederick, really appreciate your comments, Chair Kosnick. I think this is an opportunity for us to explore the different avenues for us and how we fund this critical system across the state. And as we see on the agenda, that's why I think Chair Hansen has the a bill later on to look at a constitutional amendment to look at investing in infrastructure using GO bonds funding should the people of Minnesota select that. Close the comments, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And to that point, I would say that in Human Services Committee, we're hearing about how to create that bigger system to bring in all the different stakeholders. And so this bill would be the, I guess the term was module, within that system that we're looking to get updated first that then would interconnect with everything else. So hopefully we can get it done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, we have Chair Howard, House File 3806. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Franson, members of the committee. House File 3806 authorizes $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds, our state's bread and butter tool to build housing that is affordable all across the state of Minnesota. Housing infrastructure bonds have been a tool that have been used to create more than 10,000 units of housing in a regionally balanced manner across the state. It's a tool that allows us to build everything from single family home ownership affordable to multifamily, and leverages both public and private dollars to address housing needs that but for this investment would not be built. It's a critical part of our way as a state that we address our statewide housing shortage. And what we know about this tool is that it puts shovels in the ground, and that the need is there for every project that is funded, two or three or four previously, go unfunded. So there are worthy projects all across the state, and this bill would help us move in that direction. I would note that, you know, housing infrastructure bonds is always an issue where we discuss it both in the capital investment context, but also in the housing context. We do plan to move a bill in housing committee this week that would authorize $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds, subject to an agreement with co-chair Igo and I in the housing bill. And so I'll just bring that information to bear to our discussion here today on housing infrastructure bonds, because I know it's been an area where some years it's sort of lived in the capital investment context, others in housing. But no matter the jurisdiction, it's a tool that merits our investment and allows us to help address our housing shortage all across the state.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Law, and I'm a senior policy and field building advisor with the Minnesota Consortium of Community Developers. We represent nonprofit affordable housing developers and providers working across the state to give Minnesotans both rental and homeownership opportunities. Our members support the development of housing that houses our local workforces, seniors, families, and people exiting homelessness in need of supportive services. One of our members, Project for Pride in Living, finished construction recently on 40 units of supportive housing for individuals exiting addiction in need of that had substance use disorders. I can't overstate, this project would not have been possible without our state investing in HIVs. Right now, housing operators are facing a lot of challenges that are largely beyond their control. These unprecedented challenges increase operating costs, rental arrears, significant challenges with public safety, and dramatic changes to property insurance scope and coverage. If we fail to invest in housing, we risk losing decades of public investments into the affordable housing sector, which means families with low incomes could lose their homes or be forced into homelessness. While there isn't one single solution to our state's housing crisis, there is a relatively simple solution to our state's affordable housing supply issue, and that's build more housing. We are grateful for the investments made by this committee and the Housing Committee in past sessions, but as Chair Howard or Representative Howard said, investments in HIVs simply do not keep pace with applications for funding. We know that there are many projects waiting to go in the pipeline. An average affordable housing project from idea to residents moving in can take anywhere from 6 to 8 years. So we know that these projects are ready to go and are just looking for that final gap funding through HIVs. So we thank you all so much for taking time to look into this important issue, and thank you to Representative Howard for carrying this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Franzen.
Just a question for you, Chair Lee. Does the
housing bonds count against our ability in the bonding committee?
I'll turn it over to Mr. Andy Lee.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, the housing infrastructure bond debt service used to be counted in the Capital Investment Committee General Fund target. It is now in the housing target. As far as the debt management guidelines, the housing infrastructure bonds do count towards debt management guidelines 1 and 2, but not debt management guideline number 3.
Chair Franson.
Do the bonds count against our entire, like if we have a billion-dollar bonding bill, will that count against that?
Mr. Lee.
Chairs, the in terms of guideline number 3, that's the lowest limit right now. That's about $1.2 billion. Housing infrastructure bonds would not count towards that. It would be the other piece of it, though, is in terms of coming up with the debt service. The housing infrastructure bonds, the debt service to pay for that right now is in the housing committee target, so not the capital investment committee target.
Chair Franzen.
Okay, thank you.
Members, any additional questions? Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill. I didn't hear a figure for annual debt service. I assume it depends on, you know, what the bonds are going to be floated at, but do you have a sense?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carroll, the governor's request for housing infrastructure bonds was $50 million, and it assumes $1 million in debt service starting in fiscal year 2029. That's the first year of that the debt service would start, that the state would start paying for it. It would increase over time, though. So assuming that that number is scalable, it would be about $4 million in debt service in the first year that we'd start paying. That the state would be paying interest in principal on this particular issuance of bonds in fiscal 2029, but increase later. So,
further discussion? Seeing none, close the comments. Chair Howard.
Thank you for this committee's time and focus on housing and the discussion on housing infrastructure bonds. However we get there, it's a really big priority and one that benefits the whole state. So thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Chair Jordan, House File 3748. Welcome. Please proceed.
Good morning, Capital Investment Committee. I think a number of you remember during the 23 and 24 session, there was a lot of bipartisan interest and work done to make sure that we are replacing every single lead service line in Minnesota. Lead lines are present in all communities in Minnesota, urban, rural, and suburban. And oftentimes the issue with replacing lead service lines is that they are both publicly and privately owned, which makes them ineligible for GO bonds. So today we are we've looked at cash in the past. We're also looking at appropriation bonds for this project to make sure that we can replace every lead line in Minnesota. I hope you can all recite this with me at this point, but no amount of exposure to lead is safe. And that's why we have to do this. And the most common way Minnesotans are exposed to lead in their drinking water is through these lead service lines. This is an existing program. We established this a few years ago, and it's been extremely successful. We established a 10-year goal of replacing all of these lead service lines, and we appropriated $240 million in 23. We appropriated another couple million last year. This year, we are working for $250 million to keep going to be able to replace all of those lead lines. There, again, is a lot of, in the bill that this program feeds money into, there are guardrails around ensuring that there is geographic diversity and making sure that we are targeting homeowners with the least amount of income who are also the most likely to live in a home with a lead service line, because lead service lines are associated with older home stock. So with that, I know we have a number of testifiers here. I think I'd love to turn it over to them.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. First up, we have James Leonard from Conservation Minnesota, and then if we could get John Thorson from LIUNA up, and also Director Kolstad from the PFA, and then we also have a virtual testifier. But first up, James Leonard, please identify yourself and proceed.
Sure thing. Good morning, Chairs Lee and Franzen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Lehner, and I am the Policy Associate at Conservation Minnesota. We're a nonprofit organization committed to protecting our state's environment and natural resources, including our waters. And I'm here today to speak to you in support of House File 3748, which would direct much-needed money towards the state's lead service line replacement program. Simply put, there's no safe amount of lead for humans to consume. Even small amounts of lead can have serious health impacts on humans and pose especially strong risk for children and infants. All Minnesotans need and deserve clean water in their homes, and we see investing in this work as one of the simplest and most impactful things this legislature can do. Since 2023, the state has worked to replace lead service lines across the state and map where future work needs to be done using funds allocated by this legislature and some funds from the federal government. I will say, Rep. Jordan, you've been a tremendous leader on this since that time. We thank you for that. We thank everyone who was here in 2023 for passing that funding unanimously. Really incredible work by this legislature back then. While that pot of money has been largely spent down, the Minnesota Department of Health estimates there are nearly 90,000 confirmed lead service lines still needing to be replaced, a number which could increase as inventorying continues. At that time, the state set an ambitious 10-year goal to replace every lead service line in the state, but the EPA's updated lead and copper rule, which was just recently reaffirmed earlier this year, sets a national deadline of 2037 to replace every lead pipe in the country. Either way, the message is clear. This work must get done. Clean water is an issue that touches every corner and every community in our state. As environmentalists, we believe that in order for people to care about their local lakes, rivers, and streams, they first need to trust the water running through their tap. It is with that in mind that we strongly support House File 3748 and continue the funding for the lead service line replacement program. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you for your remarks. Next up, we have Director Paul Sandy from the Brainerd Public Utilities. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, and members of the committee, my name is Paul Sandy. I'm the Public Utilities Director for Brainerd Public Utilities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 3748 and to express Brainerd's strong support for sustained funding for lead service line replacement. Brainerd Public Utilities provides water, wastewater, and electric service to the city of Brainerd and surrounding areas, and we are responsible for meeting state and federal lead service line requirements. Like many older communities, Brainerd has a significant number of lead and galvanized service lines. We have identified around 1,100 known lead lines that must be replaced, with another 500 still requiring verification through a time-intensive process involving records review, field inspections, and customer coordination. The cost to replace a single service line ranges from $10,000 to $20,000 or more. Last year, we applied for funding to replace 249 service lines at an estimated cost of $6.75 million, but we were awarded $2.675 million. This leaves most of those projects delayed and many more still waiting. A slowdown in funding does more than delay projects. It disrupts contractors who have invested in training and capacity to meet strict administrative and compliance requirements. Without consistent funding, that workforce and expertise cannot be sustained, reducing competition and increasing costs. At the same time, utilities across Minnesota are working under a mandate to address lead and galvanized service lines by 2037. Without a reliable funding pathway, meeting that deadline is very uncertain. For Brainerd, this challenge comes alongside other major investments in our wastewater and water treatment infrastructure, and this is placing added pressure on our ratepayers. Without adequate state support, those financial burdens will only grow. Brainerd is not alone. Communities across Minnesota are facing the same challenge and delays and will only make costs and compliance more difficult. We respectfully urge this legislature make a strong, sustained investment in lead service line replacement. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Director Sandy. Next up, John Thorson, La Una.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson. I'm with La Una, Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, and we help maintain and build critical infrastructure in communities all throughout the state. Here today to support House File 3748 that continues to make investments to remove lead lines in communities throughout the entire state and build on our nation-leading program that was stood up in 2023 with strong bipartisan support. In fact, I believe there was 129 votes in the House floor.
Unanimous
support. The need is great. As you've heard, there's about 87,000 confirmed lead lines in the state that need to be removed. And as Representative Jordan is wont to say, there is no safe level of lead in drinking water. The bill asks for a great deal of resources, $250 million. That's just math. For us to maintain the pace to remove all pipes in the state in our 10-year timeline by 2033, it's going to take that kind of investment going forward. To put some urgency to what we're trying to accomplish today, we need to make investments to ensure that we have a robust 27 construction season. All that has been invested in state dollars and the federal investments out of IIJA will mostly be extinguished through the 26 construction season. To have a robust 27 construction season, we're going to require at least $150 million to maintain at the level we're at. That's important because contractors plan ahead. They make investments in equipment. There's a number of contractors that say have been in earthwork and sewer and water, have made investments now to be in sewer and water and lead line replacement. You can't bounce back construction season to construction season. So us maintaining investments, as now the federal government is saying pipes need to be removed nationally by 2037, that's 9 to 12 million pipes nationwide that'll be removed. We need to stay ahead of our neighbors and keep our contractors and our workers working to remove our pipes. And I think states and regions that get water right are going to win the century, attract people to move here, invest in businesses here, and that is why we're supporting this bill today.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, good morning. My name is Raquel Vasky. I'm the General Manager of St. Paul Regional Water Services right here in St. Paul. I'm here to tell a little bit about our story. I know that you've had the chance to hear from us before, but I want to provide a little bit more detail today, and hopefully you have a handout that really shows the story of St. Paul Regional Water Services. So at project launch in 2022, we had about 26,000 lead service lines in our system alone. That's over a quarter of our customers. And we've really had a great start at this program with City of St. Paul support and with the legislative support that we've seen so far. We've been able to replace over 6,500 of the lead service lines in our system, so about a third of them will be replaced by the end of this construction year this year. And that's great. And we talk about programs, you all hear about programs every day that need more funding, that need more help. The great news about this one is it's working. So a large amount of money was dedicated to this program, and we've been able to really increase the efficiency of that program over the last 4 years. So we're fully up to speed. We've built out relationships with additional local contractors, both large and small, to make sure that this money is not only going to address the problem, but also going back into our community through jobs programs and contractor build-up programs. Our goal is to continue to chase that EPA deadline, and the good news is that that 2037 is longer than the initial 10-year plan that the state had talked about, which I think is helpful when we talk about how expensive this program is. And so now we've been able to quickly spend money, prove that it works, build up efficiency. Now I would really enjoy the opportunity to talk about what that deadline with EPA looks like. That's 11 years to get rid of the remaining lead, and how do we continue to work together year over year to make sure we can keep this great work moving. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, General Manager. Next up, we have Director Colstead from the Public Facilities Authority. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, Chair Franson, members of the committee, my name is Chad Colstead. I am the Acting Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. And I'm just going to kind of follow up on some of the stuff you've already heard from the testifiers today. I did provide just a really quick and dirty PowerPoint. It's like three slides, but it kind of summarizes all the information. So as you've already heard, we have about 87,000 lead service lines left in Minnesota to be replaced that have been identified. There's also 210,000 lead service lines that still have not been identified. So there's going to be an increasing need for lead service lines above the 87,000. We just don't know exactly how much that's going to be yet. So far, we have funded approximately $154 million of lead service line replacement projects. With the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, if we take into consideration all 5 years and assume the fifth year is about $61 million from the feds, combine that with remaining state dollars, we have about $226 million remaining. So we have $226 million remaining. We have $154 million of projects on this year's intended use plan. So those are the projects that are ready to proceed this construction season. Most likely, with lead, it's kind of unique. All those projects tend to proceed versus other projects that sit on our IEP. They don't always move forward. So assuming all $154 million of those projects move forward, we will have $72 million remaining for the 2027 construction season. To kind of meet the goals, as you've kind of heard, of the 2037, we need about $150 million a year to keep this project moving. You know, as you've heard also, the bid prices have been coming in better for these projects just because of the certainty of the funding in the state. If that funding does lapse, I don't know what's going to happen. Once those contractors leave the state and move to other states that are doing the similar work, it's going to be hard to get them back, and there's going to be a cost associated with that. So with that, I'd just like to continue end my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Director. First up, Vice Chair Fogelman.
Thank you, Chair. When you first brought this bill, this isn't really about the funding, but about who is included in the bill. I asked you if there were people in acreages that were qualified, and I was told that no. So can you help me understand why the goal is every lead pipe, but the program only applies to homes connected to public systems? Many rural Minnesotans on acreages are also taxpayers, and they still may have lead pipes. How do we justify excluding them? And if it's about eliminating lead exposures, are we leaving a gap in the public health goal?
Director Kolstad.
Chair Lee, Representative. So we've talked over the years with a lot of well drillers. Private wells are a little bit different, just the way the construction is done. You know, there's not typically a fixed lead connection to a well casing. The years when they were using lead, it would actually come above ground next to, kind of parallel to the pipe, kind of go through a little sanitary well seal on the top and then go down the well. So it's not kind of the same kind of construction method as you have with a water main and a lead service line, where there has to be some flexible connector. So that being said, we have not found any lead pipes associated with residential wells. There may be some random ones out there, but we just have not identified any. We've talked to a lot of well drillers with a lot of historic knowledge, and we just haven't heard of anything. My dad was a heating and plumbing contractor in Wisconsin, and I've never seen one either. We pulled a lot of wells over the years, and I've never seen a lead service line connected to a well.
So. Vice Chair Fogelman.
Thank you.
Chair Franzen.
This is not to do with your bill, Representative. I'm sorry, but since we do have Mr. Kolstad here. Mr. Kolstad, I kind of would like the PFA listing of where we are funding, so when we put together this next bonding bill, we are not duplicating projects that are already in the pipeline.
Yep.
Director Kolstad.
Yeah, Chair Lee, Chair Franzen. I actually did talk with your LA yesterday, so I did get them some information on the IEP status list. I'm also trying to get project lists from the agencies, PCA and Department of Health, to see what projects we've received by our construction deadline for plans and specs, which was March 31st. They're putting those together as of today, at least. So I can provide that information. And then we're slowly pulling together the needs report, which would represent kind of the needs for those communities that are on the PPL and IUP.
Chair Franzen.
Thank you. My concern is if we do local projects this year and we're going to have name grantees that maybe they're already going to be funded in this list, and I don't want to be allocating bonding dollars to projects that are already going to be taken care of.
Director Kolstad.
Yes, Chair, Representative. So if you look at the intended use plan, those are the projects that are intending to move forward. So if you can look at the Clean Water Revolving Fund or the Drinking Water Revolving Fund intended use plans, IUPs, those projects on that list are in the queue to move forward with funding. So those should not need additional appropriations. if they're triggering affordability grants, they would get affordability grant for those projects.
Okay, thank you.
Next up, Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Sorry late I came in, but and I don't know if this has been discussed at all, but out of the dollars that have been spent for the lead line repair, is there any proportionality? Is Greater Minnesota using more? Is the Metro using more? Where is the scale?
Director Kostak. Yep.
Chair Lee, Representative, you know, majority of the funding is going to the metro area. I mean, Duluth is another big user, but for the most part, St. Paul, Minneapolis are going to be the predominant, have the most need in the state for lead service line replacement.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. And it's not, you know, I'm just curious as to where we found the lead. You know, where's the majority of the lead? I know in Ely we had some numbers that showed in some of the fire hydrants they packed in lead. So when you test, mm-hmm. you test the fire hydrant, but the rest of the line isn't. You know, it's just where it's sitting in the standing water. Anyway, we're learning how, it, as you know. So go ahead, Chair. Go ahead.
Director Kostak.
Yeah, Chair Lee, Representative. I mean, the lead is all over the state. You know, the metro is dealing with a lot more, the older communities in the metro are dealing with a lot more lead. But every city, I mean, almost every city, I think 600 cities in the state, don't quote me on that exactly, but it's right around there, have at least one lead service line. So.
Close the comments, Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. This legislature has really worked to, on a bipartisan fashion, to make sure that we have clean drinking water for the people who live here and are finding creative ways to address that public infrastructure needs that can be a little bit trickier than some of the other ones that you deal with. So I appreciate the time and the creative feedback. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Next up, members, we will have a presentation on just some of the transportation bonding requests we have over the years. And so if we could have our transportation friends come up. Welcome, Director Donahoe. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Franzen and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. We are a statewide coalition of local governments, transportation industry companies, labor, professionals who work in transportation, and advocates representing thousands of Minnesotans. We greatly appreciate this opportunity to highlight the need for funding in a significant capital bonding bill for transportation infrastructure. I'd like to call your attention to some handouts that we provided. This has a list of all of the transportation bonding requests that we have. These are largely based on agency requests. There's also information on the local bridge and local road improvement programs, and also the local road wetland replacement program, which goes through Bowser and has been really important for local roads. So the transportation system does not exist in one district or one community. It is the statewide system that connects the state together, allowing products to get to markets, workers to get to jobs, students to get to school, and residents to reach important destinations. It really is the backbone of the state's economy and the system that every Minnesotan relies on every day to live their lives. Investments in roads, bridges, transit, ports, and rail, existing public assets worth billions, need to be preserved and will support industries and businesses while creating career opportunities for professionals who plan, design, build, and operate our transportation systems. Funds for the local road improvement program and the local bridge replacement program have been a fixture in past bonding bills, as these programs leverage significant federal and local dollars and will be put to work right away all across the state on projects that are ready to go, waiting for state funds. And you'll hear more about that. And these projects will be maintained by local governments. And there are also some letters in your packet from some local communities that have applied numerous times for local road funding, but there's just limited dollars and so much competition for that program. Funding for the Port Development Assistance Program will improve multimodal connections and access for freight while reducing demand on our highways. And, of course, investments in bus rapid transit and transit facilities will not only expand service, but ensure that important public transit assets are well maintained. I'd also like to note that we are requesting $400 million in trunk highway bonds for the Corridors of Commerce program. This has been a critical program for getting projects done in major corridors around the states. And right now, the Trunk Highway Fund could actually support over $600 million in trunk highway bonds without exceeding MnDOT's debt policy of not having more than 20% of the Trunk Highway Fund go to debt service. So we would really ask you to consider the ability to maximize existing funds in the Trunk Highway Fund to get some projects going around the state. So to sum up, improvements to the transportation system will save lives by reducing traffic fatalities and will allow people to live independently and access needed services and support all areas of the economy, from agriculture to manufacturing to healthcare to tourism and retail. If we want to grow the state's economy, funding for transportation infrastructure should be a priority in the capital bonding bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Next up, we have Steve Bott, City Administrator from St. Michael. Welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, and members. My name is Steve Bott. I'm the City Administrator and Public Works Director for the City of St. Michael. I'm here today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and the City Engineers Association. I'm also, per the statute for the Local Road Improvement Program, a member of the committee, the advisory committee, to the commissioner that for cities over 5,000 in population. So this is a really great program that I'm excited to advocate for. I think every member would have a project over the years of this program having touched your community. It is one that leverages state dollars. For every dollar you put into the program, it brings about $2 back. That's evident. My local community, we had one back from the funding you had for the program in 23. The local road improvement grant was for $1.5 million, and we funded a $3.5 million project. So great return on investment. Really well-run program. My compliments to MnDOT State Aid. Mark Breezy and Rashmi Brewer run the program and do a great job. It's spread throughout the state. They even are able to spread it evenly amongst MnDOT districts, both rural and metro projects, both at the county, local cities, including small cities and large state aid cities like ours, as well as townships and tribal projects, all get funded with the program. Overall, we support bonding appropriation for both this and the local bridge program that Nick's going to talk about. It helps improve and expand and replace our local roads and bridges both throughout the entire state. So it also has metrics involved. Projects are scored based on deficiencies and their proposed solutions, regional significance of the project, safety. And one of the points I want to touch on is shovel readiness, or readiness that the projects are scored. This is a program that if you're able to allocate in your bonding bill here, hopefully this session, there will be projects under construction with this project next year, for sure. It's a well-run program, gets money out the door quickly, and greatly benefits the communities that it serves. It's a extremely competitive program. With your last 2025 appropriation of $47 million, we had 233 applicants, basically spread evenly amongst the categories I mentioned, between the counties, state aid cities, small cities, and townships, roughly 50 or so each, plus or minus. In total, there was $277 million in funding requested. There is a $1.5 million per project gap that I kind of referenced earlier. Out of that, we were able to get 42 projects funded, again, split evenly amongst all those categories to fund 42 projects with the $47 million that you advocated in bonding. So overall, my sincere thanks on behalf of the other cities and counties, townships, tribes, that we represent, and hope that you can include this in hopefully a bonding bill you'll get across the finish line this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and Chair Franzen, and members of the committee. My name is Nick Klisch. I am the Redwood County Engineer, and I'm here today as a member of the Minnesota County Engineers Association, a subsidiary of the Association of Minnesota Counties. So the local bridge replacement program, referred to as LBRP, was established in 1976. As funds are appropriated to the program, projects are selected from a compilation of county board and city council resolutions that comprise a comprehensive bridge priority replacement list. Currently, the five-year list includes 924 bridges in need of replacement in the next 5 years, with an estimated total cost of over $762 million. The 2025 session included $31 million in local bridge funds, but the need remains. The money in the program has been exhausted, and there's currently a waiting list of bridges that the plan's complete, engineering's done, they're ready to go. They're just sitting there waiting for funding. Many local bridges are timber structures or large steel culverts that were constructed 50 to 70 years ago, and they're past their life. Redwood County alone has five bridges that are closed. They're just not safe to remain open, so they're closed waiting for replacement. Many other counties and townships throughout the state also have bridges that are closed. In addition to closed bridges, Redwood County has over 30 bridges that are posted for weight reductions. So that means in a rural county like Redwood, almost every farmer relies on semis and large equipment for their farming operations, and they can't utilize these bridges because they're just not strong enough for their needs. So now is a great time to invest. Redwood County recently accepted bids for a contract to replace five small bridges with concrete box culverts, and the contract came in 37% under estimate, 37%. So the result is we're gonna replace five local bridges with just $1.64 million. Another bridge contract earlier this year, a larger bridge contract for one bridge came in 11% under estimate. So many contractors are contacting counties inquiring about additional work for 2026 as they rely on consistent work and funding to stay afloat. So additional money this session would result in construction beginning on projects still this year in 2026. If Redwood County got money, we have three to five bridges ready to go that we could start on construction late summer, early fall. So thank you again for allowing me to testify to the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Brandon Nermy. I'm currently serving as the president of the Minnesota Public Transit Association, and I'm the director for Arrowhead Transit, the largest rural transit in the state, covering 10 counties in northeast and east central Minnesota. Thank you for the invitation to speak with you today about the many benefits that transit provides to all of our communities and the needs to continue those benefits. We have 40 public transit systems serving all 80 counties, though some may only cover a couple of cities instead of the entire county. Transit systems are funded through a financial partnership that includes local, state, and federal participation. Our Greater Minnesota Bus Service is affordable, flexible, cost-effective, and reliable. When people have access to transit, they're able to stay employed, remain independent members of their communities, saving the state millions in health and human services expenses. Most riders in Greater Minnesota use transit because they cannot drive or do not have access to vehicles, and it can be difficult to get rides from others. In a fairly recent survey, 75% had household incomes below $25,000. Two-thirds did not have access to a vehicle, and 26%, or only 26%, had access to a driver's license. 63% reported having a disability. So while work trips were cited as the most common type of transit trip, about 38%, at least half or more of the respondents used transit for getting to work, nearly all riding multiple days a week. 63% of those respondents stated that without the transit service, they would lose their jobs. So supporting local jobs provides further economic benefit to local communities as those workers then spend that money in the community supporting other businesses. So the Minnesota Department of Transportation estimated the current need for facility general bonding to be at about $10 million. As of last fall, the Office of Transit and Active Transportation had about $21.5 million in capital projects that they're going to need funding for over the next few years. That's facilities, capital. There will be an additional $32 million to replace buses that are already eligible to be replaced. Oops, sorry. So with the current projected investment of being just $12.7 million a year, you can see a very large difference between the need and the current investment goals. In addition, this does not account for the 3 years of increasing need that will take place as vehicles and facilities continue to age. Vehicles in some locations are stored outside due to insufficient facility sizes, which exacerbates the vehicle replacement needs. So if OTAD is awarded the general obligation bonds, then it frees up other federal state resources which can help meet some of the other needs as described. I want to give a special thanks to Representative Scraba for co-authoring this bipartisan bill to provide the $10 million to Greater Minnesota Transit. I don't mind telling you how difficult it is to secure authors for a bonding bill when the funds do not go directly to the author or the co-author's district, and they have graciously done this in support of our state's need. So in closing, thank you for the opportunity to share all the great work that our transit systems are doing in support of Greater Minnesota's needs and future community and economic development. This is a small investment that can have a major impact in supporting many communities across our great state. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Members, discussion, Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. This is to Ms. Donahue. Is it Donahue or Donahoe?
Donahoe.
Donahoe, okay, thank you. I grew up with some Donahues who spelled it the same way. That's why I wasn't sure. So on your list of needs, you have BRT, $75 million. Can you talk about that and where it would go and who's it for?
Director Donahoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's a request that the Metropolitan Council included in their agency requests. I believe it's largely directed to the H line, which would be a new bus rapid transit line. And I believe it goes in St. Paul. I can get you the details on where it would operate, but it's part of the growing network of bus rapid transit lines that they're developing.
We could have Representative Carroll connect with the Met Council on that.
Yeah.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Well, so it doesn't do anything to address the transit desert in northwest suburbs, and that was my point. So, you know, I know the east side needs a lot of help, but so do we. We haven't gotten anything. If you look at a map of the transit system, there's a black hole, you know, over our area. So I'm going to continue to advocate for it. Thank you.
Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. Obviously, this is a discussion that I could probably have all day here. First off, thank you for the testimony and the partnership with the Transportation Committee and at the Capitol here. Want to point out that it is Automated Vehicle Day, so after committee, check out some of the new technologies that will improve, I think, a lot of the transit needs that we have and revolutionize transportation systems in the future throughout the state. One of the questions was, Ms. Donahoe, you talked about the MnDOT's debt capacity of 20%. This is a conversation that we continue to have, but Mr. Lee, if you could just clarify for me and the committee, MnDOT has a guideline, but we're stuck with the MMB guideline. Just want to make sure that I caught your comments, and I know you're well aware of that, but is that correct?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, yes, so the MnDOT guideline relates to how much money of state resources can be used to pay back trunk highway bonds, the idea being that MnDOT wouldn't be paying a large share of its state resources just to service debt on projects that are already completed. The MnDOT limit is 20% of state resources. So as Ms. Donahoe noted, that the trunk highway resources relative to how much they're currently paying in debt service would allow for about $600 million in additional trunk highway bond authorization this year. However, there's also the overall state debt limits. That's a policy set by MMB includes all general obligation debt for which trunk highway bonds are one of the two types. The other is various purpose, which is usually what this committee deals with. The lowest debt capacity limit right now is guideline number 3 that relates to how quickly bonds can be paid back. In the most recent February forecast, MMB estimated that that limit that capacity, which includes both geo various purpose and trunk highway, is about 1.2. However, the legislature can go beyond that, but there would be the potential to stay within the limit. Future bills would have to be smaller. So that would I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. I appreciate re-clarifying that. We did discuss it quite a bit in transportation last year, a little bit in this committee. So there's some kind of competing guidelines. But we're stuck with the other one. So I appreciate the advocacy, but also just want to refresh for people or share that we're butting up against the MMB guidelines. So while I'd love to be able to do $600 million trunk highway bonding, we got to balance that with the needs of everything else that we have in the state. So I'm not opposed, but we are limited.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And Andy Lee, kind of tickled my brain here. So the overall bond capacity of the state is governed by MMB. So if it's 1.2, let's say that's the number, the total, 1.2. And if we wanted $600 million in transportation bonds, who is responsible for making that decision? Who makes the decision how much each one? Is it the governor? Is it legislature? How does that, or is that what comes together in the end?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scraba, the legislature sets how much state the debt has, or how much debt the state has. MMB has established a debt management guideline in order to, when they present to bond houses to sell state debt, show that the state is managing its state and setting internal limits. The legislature can exceed the MMB policy, although when the state sells future debt, the MMB would have to notify future potential bond buyers that the state has exceeded its internal limit. The state has almost exceeded its debt limit under an old guideline that limited the state to a certain percentage of general fund revenue for debt service. That was at 3%. And the state was about to exceed that limit simply because of the Great Recession and a sudden decrease in tax collections. Around that era, the state set out these new guidelines that limit the state to a principle of not exceeding a limit related to state personal income, so sort of a macroeconomic number of the state economy. The lowest limit right now that was under discussion, guideline number 3, applies to how quickly the state pays back bonds. That limit is lower because of bonds that were issued in the past that have that are sold over many, many years. It might be a longer discussion, but
Representative Scraba.
And if they're not used, that goes against it, and the whole big picture. But so, does our action? I'm curious. Obviously, that's why I'm asking the question. But so, does our action at the end, saying we want X dollars in bonding, direct where that money goes? I mean, who actually says if the money that we're talking about now, well, the trunk highway bonds are from a different source, but the other bonding, is it the action of the legislature towards when we're budgeting the very end? Is that what determines how much goes where, or is it from? I think I'm getting the answer.
Representative Scrabo, it will be up to our legislative leaders to see how they want to allocate. You know, for example, if they want to do $600 million in trunk highway bonds, then we have a limit of 1.2 that we might be able to only do $600 million in general obligation bonds. And so those are the discussions that's being happening right now at the top, and so we'll see what our directions are. Thank you for your presentation today. Next on the agenda, House File 3352, Chair Hansen. And then for the testifiers that we have for this bill, please, we are running a little bit behind, so just keep your remarks short, too. Chair Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3352 is a constitutional amendment. And because it is a constitutional amendment, I am going to provide you as the author with my intent. The intent of this constitutional amendment is to provide the same type of capital investment for technology as we do for physical infrastructure, for buildings. And so buildings, roads, bridges. The key point here, and if you look at our bonding law, constitution, there's a number of things that we can bond for, but I'd ask you to flip over to the back of the page, and it says, to pay capital cost of design, acquisition, installation, construction, equipping, and servicing public information, technology systems, licenses, and infrastructure. It's 2026. We haven't changed our abilities on bonding. We have heard, in the healthcare world and in many other places where our technology systems have not kept up. And providing another tool in terms of using bonding to pay for that technology is important. It would be my thought that it would be through a capital investment committee just in the House and the Senate. It would be another thing like appropriation bonds if the voters approve this. And as we're approaching now the middle of the century, I think it's important where we look at infrastructure, critical infrastructure, for technology beyond just the buildings. I have several testifiers who can talk about the need.
Yep, so first up, we have Matt Peabody, director from Olmsted County for their information technology solutions. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Matt Peabody. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the director of information technology solutions, as you said, at Olmsted County. I also serve as the chair of the Minnesota County IT Leadership Association. Today, I'm here to testify in favor of the House File 3352. Over the past decade, counties have made strong investments in technology, IT staff, and cybersecurity capabilities. The state, through Minute, has also prioritized technology investments, especially providing technical resources and guidance to local governments. These investments have given Minnesota a baseline, but as recent cyber attacks on local governments demonstrate, we can and should do more. Counties' current funding models include using grants, one-time funding sources, or operational budgets through levies. These funding models have kept IT systems running, but many have fallen into disrepair. House File 3352 would allow state and local governments to conduct long-term planning for systems replacement. Minnesota already funds roads and bridges because their failure or disrepair is unacceptable. We strongly believe IT infrastructure falls into this category as it is also considered critical infrastructure. It's many times woven into those sectors also. Other states like Massachusetts have already taken this step, authorizing over $1.6 billion in bonded IT and cybersecurity investments, including funding for local governments. Simply put, House File 3352 would give legislature another tool in its toolbox to ensure our IT infrastructure is well maintained and kept resilient against cyber attacks. I want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this bill forward and the committee for allowing me to testify today. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Director. Next up, we have Kenneth Yvonne. Please identify yourself, proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, and members of the House Capital Investment Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Kenneth Abon, and I'm here today as the 2025-2026 Humphrey Policy Fellow. When I began my Humphrey Fellowship, I made a commitment to myself to pursue an issue in a policy area that I wasn't as familiar with. I thought maybe I would work on public safety or transportation or energy, but I promise you I never thought I would end up working on capital investment policy, let alone a constitutional amendment on public financing. And yet here I am today to testify in support of House File 3352 because financing to upgrade our public IT systems is a critical strategy to prevent fraud and protect Minnesotans. As many Minnesotans, our group has been following the reports of fraud in our publicly funded programs. Upgrading public IT infrastructure is a pivotal component of a fraud prevention strategy. Several reports from the Office of the Legislative Auditor recommend upgrades to outdated information systems to improve agency oversight of state programs. Modernizing large complex systems like Maxis or PRISM will provide government employees with a tool to more effectively and diligently do their jobs and ensure our tax dollars are being used for their intended purpose. However, the cost of modernizing multiple complex IT systems in a short period of time will be cost prohibitive through general appropriations. However, allowing for general obligation bonds for these types of projects allows you to upgrade systems as needed without having to compete with all the other priorities in the biennial budget. In addition to fraud prevention, this bill can enhance our state's ability to invest in cybersecurity at state and local level. Just in the last year, there have been cyber attacks against the city of St. Paul, Freeborn County, Olmsted County, Maurer County, and two in Winona County just in the last 4 months. Personal identification, financial information was stolen, emergency system alerts or alert systems were hacked, and several systems and services were held for ransom. Providing public financing to upgrade county and city IT infrastructure protects Minnesota residents and the services they rely on. I strongly encourage you to support House File 3352. It's time to update the Constitution to meet our current financing needs so we can adequately prevent fraud and protect Minnesotans' information and services. Article 11, Section 5 of the Minnesota Constitution has not been amended since 1982. The infrastructure that has become a part of our daily lives has changed significantly in the last 44 years. Minnesota cannot forge ahead into the 2030s while our definition of critical infrastructure is stuck in the 1980s. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Next up, we have Nabiha Mohammed. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nabiha Mohammed. I am a Humphrey Policy Fellow and a Director of Programs at HealthGuard Partners, a small assisted living provider. I'm here today to express my strong support for HF 3352. In the assisted living setting, providers depend heavily on the effectiveness of IT systems related to eligibility, licensing, authorizations, reporting, and service administration. Unfortunately, the current IT infrastructure is outdated and the reality impacts directly day-to-day service delivery. At the provider level, we are often required to document and verify the same core information across state assessment systems, state billing systems, and internal care documentation that are not fully integrated. This results in repeated data entry, manual reconciliation of records, and an increased risk of documentation errors, all of which take time away from direct resident care. We also see this challenge in the coordination between licensing and billing systems managed by MDH and DHS, respectively. MDH issues and license providers must then submit these documentations to DHS in order to maintain accurate billing status. There is often a lag between MDH renewal and DHS recognition of the updated status. This oftentimes delays billings and directly impacts provider cash flow. These delays affect staffing stability. These issues are not isolated administrative inconveniences. They are system-level gaps that create inefficiency, increase provider burden, and directly affect financial stability and service continuity. HF 3352 is important because it strengthens Minnesota's ability to make long-term investments in the IT infrastructure that health and human services depend on, including funding to improve system integration and alignment across agencies so systems can communicate more effectively. That means less duplication, fewer delays, reduced administrative burden for agency workers, providers, and a more stable, coordinated experience for the individuals receiving services. For these reasons, I respectfully ask for your support of HF 3352. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Last up, we have Denise Mejia. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Denise Shmaya. I am the Director of Data Leadership for the Education Partnerships Coalition of Minnesota, or EPC. I'm here today in support of House File 3352. EPC is a bipartisan coalition of 9 cradle-to-career partnerships across Minnesota. Together, we work with more than 600 local organizations and support over 300,000 young Minnesotans and their families. Our shared goal is simple: to ensure every child and young person in this state has the opportunity to succeed. Our work spans greater Minnesota, the metro, and urban communities. Leaders from red, purple, and blue communities come together around outcomes that matter: economic mobility, long-term self-sufficiency, and opportunity for Minnesota families. A core part of my role at EPC is leading the statewide development of a statewide integrated data infrastructure to support cradle-to-career outcomes. This work focuses on strengthening data systems within and across agencies so Minnesota can better understand and improve education to workforce pathways and expand economic opportunities statewide. Our goal with data is to ensure communities have access to aggregate data that is accurate, accessible, timely, and actionable. Data that supports locally led decisions and meaningful action, particularly for young people and families underserved by existing systems. Through repeated conversations with practitioners and policymakers, the message is clear. Minnesota's data system needs updating, and data must be easier to access and use to evaluate program effectiveness. To achieve this, Minnesota must expand investment in public information technology systems, licenses, and data infrastructure. These investments help ensure public services are designed around the people who use them, can adapt over time, and ultimately strengthen trust, accessibility, and outcomes for all Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. On behalf of EPC and the communities we serve, we respectfully ask for your bipartisan support of House File 3352.
Thank you. Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions, Chair Hanson. On line 2.8, I was surprised to see servicing and licensing. I see that more as ongoing operations and maintenance function as opposed to an investment function that we would normally use bonds for. Just like see, hear your comments.
Chair Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sexton. I think that is one piece that can be clarified, because I'm not talking about using the bond funds to pay for the licenses, but to provide for that infrastructure that could run licensing systems, if that helps. Yeah, so it's not, operating or paying for a license, but it, when you've got the infrastructure that has to be operated, the hardware that pays for the licensing systems. And we're grappling with it. The agencies are grappling with this. I'll use DNR as an example. That was supposed to be due, what, Representative Scraba, a year ago? You know, so it's not the licensing fee. It's that should be paid for out of their operating budget.
Representative Sexton.
How about servicing? Do you see that as the operating budget or?
Chair Hanson.
Mr. Chair, I see that also as service, you know, the if you're having someone come in to repair, that's an operating budget.
Correct. Maybe that's clarification, I guess.
Mr. Chair, I would use servicing as a verb that is relating to that construction, building that hardware that is needed for technology.
Sure, I saw that as installation, yeah. And servicing is more O&M, so right. Potentially some cleanup could be done on this.
Close the comments, Chair Hanson.
It's my intent that hopefully we can get this onto the ballot, if not in 2026 in the future. The need is still going to be there. It's going to increase, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Hanson. Members, thank you for being here and for the great discussion today. With no further business before us, Chair Franzen has the gavel on Thursday, April 16th. The meeting is adjourned.